Okay. Well, good evening. It's good to be here this evening. We are going into the books of Ezra and Nehemiah this evening. And before we get into the details of the book, let's look a little bit at sort of a chronology of the period, understanding what we're talking about. Back as we came to the end of Second Chronicles, and as you'll note, the beginning of Ezra, the beginning verses of Ezra are the ending verses of Second Chronicles. The book of Ezra, in that sense, picks up the story where Chronicles concludes. Second Chronicles ended with, of course, the Babylonian captivity. Nebuchadnezzar came in three different invasions. The first invasion was in 604 B.C., and which Judah, he replaced the king that was on the throne and put someone more to his liking, another of the royal family members on the throne. He put Judah in a situation where it was a tributary state, part of the Babylonian Empire. Well, things went on along, and Nebuchadnezzar was dissatisfied. About 7 years later, he came back around 597, and this time took the city and took some people, including the king who was on the throne at the time. He took him captive to Babylon and put his brother Zedekiah on the throne, and Zedekiah was also a son of King Josiah, and Judah had as its last rulers three of Josiah's sons plus one of his grandsons, and anyway, Nebuchadnezzar in 597 took some people captive and did some things to make Judah toe the line. Well, Zedekiah, a little later, several years went by, and he became emboldened and thought that he could team up with Pharaoh down in Egypt and manage to get out of paying tribute to Babylon. And that didn't work. Nebuchadnezzar came back for the final time, which was about 587, 586, different sources give different years. It was that time period. Came in and this time not only took people captive, but he destroyed the city, burned Jerusalem, took everything of value, looted the treasures of the temple, took those to Babylon, destroyed the temple, destroyed Jerusalem, just devastated the area. And so now the Jews were in complete captivity. Decades passed, and in fact about almost 50 years went by to the time in 539 B.C. when the Medes and the Persians conquered Babylon. They had laid siege around it, conquered Babylon, and that account is told in the book of Daniel. So Cyrus, who was the king, or maybe you better style the emperor of the empire of the Medes and the Persians, placed Darius the Mede on the throne of Babylon. Darius, who was related to Cyrus. Cyrus, on his mother's side, was of the Median royal family, and he united in his person the Medes and the Persians. His mother was a Median princess, and his father was a Persian prince, and so Cyrus had united the Medes and the Persians. Well, he put Darius the Mede on the throne there in Babylon to reign as king of Babylon, and Cyrus went on to pursue the main Babylonian army, which was not at Babylon at that time. It was elsewhere, and he came back a little later, a year or so later, and then issued a decree that allowed the Jews to return to Jerusalem. gave them permission to leave Babylon. And that's where the story of the book of Ezra opens, with Zerubbabel, who was of the royal family of Judah, a descendant of King David. Zerubbabel is a name that name or title that he was given because that name means out of Babylon, leader out of Babylon. And so that was you find him referred to by a couple of different names here, and Zerubbabel is evidently the title or name. Sheshbazzar in Ezra 1:8 is evidently a reference to Zerubbabel. And perhaps it was not uncommon for someone to have more than one name, and Zerubbabel itself was evidently given to him in the aftermath of his leading the people back. He was appointed governor by Cyrus, governor of Judah, and he came back along with Joshua, who was of the priestly line, and he came back as high priest. And so the story in Ezra opens with Zerubbabel and Joshua coming back, leading a contingent of Jews back from Babylon, now with permission to rebuild a temple in Jerusalem. And they come back to do that. And the opening part of the book of Ezra tells the story of their efforts as they come back and they dedicate an altar to God and they begin the construction on the temple. Now, along with Zerubbabel and Joshua, there are two other individuals of note, and that is two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah. And those were the four of these men were all contemporary. They came back here in the this period here of the 530s, and they began the process of rebuilding the temple. And what we find is that the temple makes some progress and they get it partially done, and there are enemies of the Jews who stir up trouble. In effect, what they do is they make complaints to the Persian king. They hired counselors, in other words, the equivalent of lawyers, and they. In our terminology, they got an injunction to prohibit the building of the temple. They went and they made all sorts of accusations, and they got things stirred up, and the construction of the temple came to a stop, and it stayed stopped for several years. And Haggai and Zechariah intervened and stirred things up and told the people and told Zerubbabel, look, you need to finish the work God has sent you to do. And so they did that, which then sent their enemies ballistic, because the enemies were all upset. Why these rebellious Jews? They're building this wicked and rebellious city, and they're building this terrible temple, and all they were upset. And so they made more inquiries to the Persian court, and things were stirred up. And finally, Darius has the records. They examine the records, and they find the decree where Cyrus had given them permission. And so, in effect, Darius lifts the injunction, and they complete the temple. Not a dissimilar story, by the way, to the receivership of 1979. It's an interesting parallel that you find. What you really find is that Satan is not an original thinker. He comes up with a few good plans, and he just repeats them century after century after century. It's pretty easy to know what he's going to do. Just read and see what he's done. And you sort of recognize the same thing. Because ultimately, there are two main ways of getting God's people off the track. One is you entice them. Come on over to my place. Whether it was the Midianite women, back in the account there of the Exodus, when Balaam taught Balak to this plan. Now come on over to my place. You find this here in Ezra and Nehemiah. The Samaritans and the others. Hey, come on over. Join in the fun. Join the party. So you entice people to begin to compromise and to there is an enticement to blend in and to fit in with the world around us. And so that has always been a successful ploy, and it generally works best after the initial excitement of starting out has sort of ebbed. You know, emotion does not stay at a fever pitch. I don't care in what facet of human conduct, you know, you can, when people start out and they're emotional, everything's all stirred up, it's all excited. As time goes on, you know, it sort of settles down, that the decibel level drops a little bit. And there's an enticement that's held out. And we see that in both the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. And for those who are not enticed, then Satan's other ploy is intimidation and coercion. You know, if you can't entice them to come on over and join the party, then try to intimidate them into at least quit doing what they're doing. Make them pull back, intimidate them, coerce them, pressure them. And that, again, we see running through here. Now, the temple is completed. And the book of Ezra is interesting in this regard, because you come down to the completion of the temple around 516, so right at that general period. And you have a gap of over 50 years. Whole generation, that generation dies, and about a little over 50 years later, we pick back up with Ezra coming back. This is in the days of King Artaxerxes. Darius the First, through whom much of the activity, the completion of the temple, was under Darius the First. He reigned from 522 to 486. Xerxes, who was his successor, and was the husband of Queen Esther, he was the successor to Darius. He reigned from 486 to 464, and then Artaxerxes comes to. He is the next successor, and he's the one that the rest of the books of Ezra and Nehemiah are during his reign. He was from 464 to 423, and when this 50 year is sort of a curtain drops and it raises about 50 years later when Ezra returns. And when he gets back, what he finds is that even though the temple has been rebuilt, the city itself has not. The walls have not been built up. The city is scarcely inhabited. The people have widely intermarried with the peoples around them, the Samaritans and the Ammonites and others. And they're on the verge of losing their identity. They're about to be absorbed just into the general mix of people around. They have watered down everything. Well, Ezra comes back, and he has been given a commission by the king. He has been allowed to bring back the rest of the temple treasures. And one of the things he brings back is the official temple copy of the scriptures. And it describes when Cyrus told him, you know, you can go back and teach the law of God, which is in your hand. So he was actually bringing it back, transporting back this copy. And Ezra is accorded in Jewish tradition the fact that he was responsible for putting the Old Testament in the order and putting it together in the way that it was preserved by the Jews. Well, Ezra came back and he taught vigorously and tried to insist on certain reforms, but not a whole lot happened. People sort of agreed and went along partially, but it didn't work. And several years go by, and Ezra came back in 457, and then it is about 12 or 13 years later that Nehemiah comes back as governor. Nehemiah has found out, he is a servant there of the Persian king, and he's found out that really nothing has happened. And he asks the king for the appointment as governor and is given it. Nehemiah comes back, and he has civil authority to enforce Ezra's reforms. And the book of Nehemiah tells the story, and Ezra and Nehemiah both figure in it. But Nehemiah is an interesting person. As you read the story, he is certainly one of the most forceful, determined leaders that that you read of in the Scripture. You know, if Bible characters were football coaches, Nehemiah would be Vince Lombardi. I mean, he was tremendously focused and motivated. And when you read the way he handled some situations, you really wouldn't want to tangle with Nehemiah. I mean, it's interesting. You know, God's used different people, different personalities, different strengths and weaknesses. Nehemiah was an individual who was, you needed a man like Nehemiah for this job, because it was a situation that required someone who really had that sort of focus and determination. And it's an interesting parallel. One of the things we get into in this section is we see the role of the Samaritans. And this, of course, sets the stage for what you read in the New Testament, because the Samaritans play a role in the New Testament. One, we're introduced, Jesus meeting the woman at the well in Samaria, and the fact that the Jews had no dealings with the Samaritans. Why did the Jews have such antagonism? And you remember the Samaritan woman asked Christ, she says, well, our forefathers say this place, this mountain, is where you need to worship. You Jews say that Jerusalem is the place. And, you know, Christ made a very blunt statement to her. He said, you don't know what you worship, you Samaritans. You don't have a clue. You don't even know what you worship. We know what we worship for salvation is the Jews. Now, you know, that's a pretty strong statement. You know, it's like you tell a Catholic or a Baptist, you don't have a clue as to what you're worshiping. I know what I worship. You know, salvation is where we are. Well, boy, you know, you expect that sort of stirs up people a little bit. Christ was very emphatic with that with the Samaritans. And there's a reason. And we see that as we understand the role the Samaritans played, because the other place you read about the Samaritans is in Acts 8. And you read about the great religious leader of the Samaritans, a man by the name of Simon. Simon the sorcerer, Simon Magus, as he's called in secular history. You know, it's interesting. If you look in the New Encyclopedia Britannica, you find a little entry about yay big about Simon, just a little paragraph. The old 11th edition Britannica, which you almost need a magnifying glass to read print, I mean, it's tiny, has about 5 pages devoted to Simon Magus. I mean, just incredible. There's a lot of things he was mentioned in the writings of a lot of the early church fathers, and he played a significant role. And ultimately, you see, when you understand what the Samaritans did, the Samaritans, as we saw last time in 2 Kings 17, and that's a crucial chapter, because God spends time explaining things, where explaining origins. Origins are important because the past holds a key to the future. What you learn about the Samaritans in 2 Kings 17 is that they were of Babylonian origin. They were men from Babylon and the suburbs around Babylon. They were brought to northern Israel and settled there by the Assyrians after they had deported the Israelite people. Then you find that the Samaritans, sort of an odd phrase is used about them. It says they feared the Eternal and served their own gods. In other words, they paid lip service to God. They talked about the God of Israel. They proclaimed allegiance and worship to Yahweh, the God of Israel. But in reality, they continued to serve and to practice the old pagan religion, to serve the old pagan gods of Babylon. They practiced Babylonian paganism under the guise of worshiping the true God of Israel. That's why when you come here to Zerubbabel and later to Ezra and Nehemiah, they refused the offer of the Samaritans to participate. And to, the Samaritans said, "Why, we worship your God as you do." And Zerubbabel says, "Oh, no, you don't." Nehemiah said, "Oh, no, you don't. We're not going to let you guys come in here." Because you see, the Samaritans, what they did in the Old Testament is exactly what they later did in the New Testament. They took biblical terminology and applied it to pagan customs and practices. And they blended the two together. Now, that may sound familiar because that's what's given us what we, what the world knows as Christianity. And it played a role. And part of the reason that some of this is contained and some of these details are given in the Old Testament is it introduces us to the people who played a major role in the New Testament. Because just as in the New Testament, the true church of God was built around the Jewish diaspora in the various cities of the Roman Empire, it was built around the Jews and the Gentiles who came to the synagogue, known as God-fearers. That term you see in the New Testament often talks about Paul would address the synagogue, men of Israel and you that fear God. Well, this term, God-fearer, was a technical term that referred to Gentiles who kept the Sabbath, who attended synagogue but weren't circumcised. And they weren't full proselytes. They had not been circumcised. But they came and attended the synagogue every Sabbath. And they kept the Sabbath and they did various things. The Church of God was built on the Jewish diaspora. There was another church that was built on the Samaritan diaspora because what most people don't realize is the Samaritans had been scattered as well to an extent after the days of Alexander the Great. And the two main outposts of the Samaritans were Rome and Alexandria, Egypt, two greatest centers of Samaritan population outside of Samaria. So guess where Simon the sorcerer traveled and where he was able to build a great following, because in Acts 8 we're told that he was the one to whom all the Samaritans gave heed, from the greatest to the least. They all gave heed to Simon, saying he was the great power of God. He was the Pontifex Maximus. He was the head fellow. Well, anyway, with that in mind, this background, let's come here through this section here in Ezra. Ezra 1, verse 1, "In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, and he made a proclamation. And his proclamation was that, as it mentions in verse 3, whoever is among you wants to go up to Jerusalem and build the house of the Lord God of Israel, let him go up." And so we find that there was a collection taken up. And Cyrus, verse 7, brought forth vessels of the house of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had brought forth out of Jerusalem and had put in the house of his gods. And so it describes some of these things. And this was sent back to Jerusalem by Zerubbabel and the children of the captivity, who are detailed here. Verse 2 starts out with Zerubbabel and Joshua and various others. It goes through this list of individuals and groups of people. This is one of the things, by the way, that the treasures from the temple that Zerubbabel brought back, many of them, Ezra brought back the rest, and the Ark of the Covenant is not among these treasures. The Ark of the Covenant was not brought back. So it's clear the Ark of the Covenant would have been the greatest single treasure that the Babylonians could have taken, and it was not there. It was not present in the Second Temple. And so that comes out. Now, as we come on through the story, we find that in chapter 3, when the seventh month was come, the children of Israel children of Israel were in the cities, and the people gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem. And we find that they set up the altar, verse 3, and they kept the Feast of Tabernacles, verse 4, as it is written. And they offered the continual burnt offering, verse 5. Verse 6, from the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings unto the Lord. And this included the first day of the seventh month was the Feast of Trumpets. And they began to offer burnt offerings unto the Lord. The foundation of the temple of the Lord was not yet laid. So one of the things we would recognize from this is that it is when we read of burnt offerings and future offerings to be offered that will be cut off, it's not necessary, may be, but it's not necessary that a temple be completed. Or for that matter, even in this case, even the foundation hadn't been laid yet. Just the altar was dedicated. And that is the starting point. They went on to build the temple, and it was in the second year of their coming, verse 8, in the second month, that they set forward the work. They began to set forward the work of the house of the Lord. And it describes the laying of the foundation and certain things. Now, one of the things it mentions is that when they began the building of the temple, that there was a great shout, verse 11, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But there were elderly men among them who remembered the old temple. At this time, the temple had been destroyed for just over 50 years. So it was... They came back... it was by the time it was completed, 70 years from the destruction had passed. But this is when they began it. And it was because it took them almost 20 years to build the temple. Here in this account, because they had stopped for a period in the middle. But they're, you know, the ones who could remember the original temple were, it was a sad occasion in one sense, because what they saw taking shape was so much smaller and such a much less impressive and grand building than the building of Solomon. Now, Chapter 4, verse 1 says, when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin, note which tribes had returned, it was not all 12 of them. There may have been an individual here or there from some of the other tribes, but basically it was Judah and Benjamin. That was who made up the southern kingdom. When the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity built the temple to the Lord God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel, the chief of the fathers, and said unto them, let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do. We sacrifice unto him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Asher, who brought us up here. And Zerubbabel and Joshua said to them, verse 3, you have nothing to do with us to build a house to our God. we ourselves will build unto the Lord God of Israel, as Cyrus king of Persia commanded us. Then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in building, hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, even till the days of Darius. So the first thing they did was try to draw them into compromise. Why, we're all, you know, we're all doing the same thing. We're all trying to go to the same place. We'll just help you out and, you know, we'll just all do this thing together. Well, you see, you can't compromise with the world because when you do, you lose your identity. They didn't really worship God as the Israelites, as the Jews worship God. You know, 2 Kings 17 makes it plain. They feared the Eternal. They feared Yahweh and served their own gods. They practiced Babylonian paganism under biblical terminology. They talked about the Bible. They talked about the God of Israel. They paid lip service to various things. But they didn't do it the way it was supposed to be done. So, it's apparent. You see, what were they really? They were adversaries. Their first attempt was to entice and to effect a compromise. When Zerubbabel refused to compromise, then they showed their true colors. They stirred up trouble. They weakened the hands of the people and troubled them in building. They just stirred up trouble. They spread rumors. They tried to discourage people. They just, in general, created a problem. And the other thing they did was they, in effect, went to court. And they dragged this thing out for years. And, it was just something over and over all through various kings, as it mentions here, some of the things that they did. Here's one example. We'll pick it up in verse 12, chapter 4, verse 12. Be it known unto the king that the Jews which came up from you to us are come unto Jerusalem, building the rebellious and the bad city. And they set up the walls thereof and joined the foundation. Now, you know, isn't it amazing how you can report facts and put a twist on them as though it were something negative? You know, those Jews have come up from you. They're building that rebellious and bad city. It's a terrible thing they're doing. Now, here they make an accusation, verse 13. They say, if this city is built and the wall set up again, they're not going to pay toll, tribute, or custom, and they're going to endanger the revenue of the king. You know, the real reason we're writing to you, king, is we really are concerned. We don't want to see you cut short in the money you're supposed to receive. That's our main. That's the only motive we have. Is we're just such loyal, patriotic citizens. We know these bunch of deadbeats over here. The reason they're building a wall, we're sure. I mean, the only reason they're building a wall is because they don't plan on paying their taxes anymore. And we really want to make sure you get all the taxes you have coming. And so that's, you know, the only reason we're saying anything. And so, isn't it amazing? I mean, you just put a twist on things. And they said, now, if you'll search in the book of the records of your fathers, verse 15, you'll find out this city is a rebellious city. It's hurtful to kings and provinces. They've moved with sedition back in the old times. This is why it was destroyed. Said, why this city has been in trouble? Why that? This is why it was. We certify to the king. If this city is built again, the walls are set up. You'll have no portion on this side of the river. They're gonna begin a rebellion. And so they went down and they searched the records and they said, verse 20. You know, there have been mighty kings over Jerusalem, which have ruled over all the countries around here. And so we're going to give a commandment to cause these men to cease, that the city be not builded until another commandment shall be given from me. So this letter was read, and they made them to cease, verse 23, made them to cease by force and power. And the work of the house of God ceased in the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And so here we find this all this trouble. Now, Haggai and Zechariah are mentioned in chapter 5. You can, of course, read their books in the Minor Prophets, but they're mentioned here. And they rose up and prophesied in the name of the God of Israel and told Zerubbabel, get on with the work. And Zerubbabel and Joshua rose up and began to build the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. And at the same time, now when that happened, the boy, this really stirred things up. See, they didn't have a court order that said they could resume building. They just started building again. Which was sort of Mr. Armstrong's approach when the receiver got his court order, you know, to cause things to cease and desist, that just keep on going. Well, what did they say? Who has commanded you? Chapter 5, verse 3. Who's commanded you to build this house and to make up this wall? What are the names? You know, we want to take down names to send to the king. And verse 5, but the eye of their God was upon the elders of Judah, that they could not cause them to cease till the matter came to Darius. You know, when God watched over them and he worked things out, and this thing dragged on, and they weren't able to stop it. And finally, these letters go back and forth, and when the governor wrote, he said, verse 10 told the king, or verse 9, he says, we asked those elders, who commanded you to build this house and to make up these walls? We asked their names so that we could write to you and tell you who was doing all this. And here's the answer they gave us, verse 11, when we asked their names. They said, we're the servants of the God of heaven and earth. And we build the house that was builded these many years ago, which a great king of Israel built and set up. And so he goes through and tells the story. And how Cyrus had made a decree and sent the vessels back. And search was made in the king's treasure house, verse 17. And we find that they did this. They started looking up the records, chapter 6, and finally they found in one of the palaces a copy of this record where Cyrus had commanded the temple to be rebuilt. And so it describes here in all of the things Darius issued the decree to allow that to be implemented. And verse 15, this house was finished on the third day of the month Adar, in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king. And then they kept the dedication. And verse 22, the days of Feast of Unleavened Bread were kept 7 days with joy. Adar is the 12th month of the Hebrew calendar. So they completed it. If you completed it in the third day of the month Adar, this was, let's say, about 6 weeks before Passover. And so they had the dedication there at the Passover season. Now, in chapter 7, we pick up the story about 50 years later. After these things, in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra, and it describes who Ezra's background. He was a priest and traces his lineage back to Aaron. Ezra went up from Babylon, verse 6. He was a ready scribe in the law of Moses, which the Lord God of Israel had given. The king granted him all his requests according to the hand of the Lord his God upon him. And there went up some of the children of Israel and the priests and the Levites and the singers in the seventh year of Artaxerxes the king. They came to Jerusalem, verse 8, in the fifth month, in the seventh year of the king. And upon the first day of the first month, they began to go up from Babylon. And on the first day of the fifth month, he came to Jerusalem. So it took him 4 months to make the trip. Now, Ezra, verse 10, had prepared his heart to seek the law of God and to do it and to teach in Israel statutes and judgments. So he came back for the purpose of teaching the law. And this is the copy of the decree of Artaxerxes that had made a decree in verse 14. For as much as you're sent of the king and of his seven counselors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God which is in your hand. So he was bringing back the temple scrolls, the law of God which was in his hand, to carry silver and gold which is being sent, and all these things to buy the things that were needed. And so Ezra made the decree that all of whatever was needed was to be paid, and they were sent back. And as you come on down through the story, we sort of an interesting thing here in chapter 8. It talks about Ezra and all this group that was with him. And as you come on down to verses 21 and 22, I think it's just maybe a little humorous. Ezra stopped there at the river and proclaimed a fast to seek God here with this group that was coming back. Verse 22, here's why he did that. For I was ashamed to require of the king a band of soldiers and horsemen to help us against the enemy in the way. Because we had spoken unto the king, saying, the hand of our God is upon all them for good that seek him, but his power and his wrath is against all them that forsake him. So we fasted and besought our God for us, and he was entreated of us. Ezra and this group that was coming back from Babylon, they were loaded down with gold and silver and had all this treasure, and they were coming on back, you know, and they got up there to the river when they were ready to cross out of the province of Babylon and begin this trek, you know, across coming to Jerusalem. And they got up there, and they got to sort of looking around, and they got nervous. They were scared. They said, you know, we are sitting ducks. We don't have any soldiers with us. We don't have any weapons to protect us. We're loaded down with silver and gold. We're sitting ducks for any bandits and thieves and anybody to hijack us and steal all this stuff. You know, the king has been very favorable. We could ask him and he'd send an escort. But it says we were ashamed to do that because Ezra had just finished laying it on really strong to the king about how the God we serve is the real God, and he protects those that serve him, and he blesses them, and the people that don't serve him, he curses. And the king had been pretty impressed with this, and he said, well, he threw in some extra gold and silver and said, now, when you get down there to sacrifice, I want you to buy some bulls and goats and sacrifice them for me, you know, and put in a good word for me. When you go down there, that was part of the decree. You know, you got to pray for the king too. And, the king, why should wrath come on the king and the king's sons? Because the temple in Jerusalem is lying desolate. So Ezra had laid it on really thick, and the king had said, yeah, well, that sounds pretty good. Now, you have to understand, this king had a background on that. Because who was this king's father? This king's father was Xerxes. Xerxes was the husband of Esther. See, this king had grown up knowing Esther, knowing Mordecai. So when Ezra came along and laid this on, well, this king was willing to issue all these decrees and all this. Now Ezra's up here at the river, and he says, I can't go back and tell the king I'm scared to make the trip. I need some soldiers to protect me. I just got through telling him, how great our God is. You know, it's sort of a lesson for us. You know, sometimes when you really lay it on thick, and all of a sudden you find yourself in a spot, and you think, man, I don't know if I want to go through there by myself. So Ezra did exactly the thing he should have done. You know, he got there. One of the things I like about this account is it's so realistic. It's so human. You know, it's the spot we all find ourselves in sometimes, where we have just gotten through really explaining to somebody else and just laying it on. You know, you need to trust God, and you just trust God and have confidence. You just need to step out in faith. And then all of a sudden you find yourself in a jam and you think, oh my, what in the world am I going to do? Well, Ezra did exactly the right thing. He and the people, he said, you know, we better pass. We better really ask God, because if he doesn't watch over, somebody's going to knock us in the head and take all this stuff. So they fasted and they prayed and they sought God and they went on their trip. And I think that's a very realistic lesson of faith for us, because we all, sometimes you read the account and you think, well, people in the Bible, it was easy for them to have faith. You know, they just were sort of born, faith just sort of popping out there. Faith popping out all over. Well, they were human beings like we were, and they had their weaknesses and everything. But Ezra handled it the right way. He did that. We prayed, fasted, besought our God. Verse 23. He was entreated. So they came on down, and they brought all of these things that were there. And chapter 9. When these things were done, the princes came unto me. Said, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the land, doing according to their abominations. Verse 2, they've taken their daughters, the holy seed, have mingled themselves with the people of these lands. And the hand of the princes and the rulers have been chief in this trespass. Now that was where the trouble was. The trouble started at the top. And we're going to see when we get to... chapter 10, verse 1, Ezra prayed, and he had confessed, weeping and casting himself down before the house of God, and really beseeching God, because he could just see that everything that they were trying to do was on the verge of being wiped away. You can't... When things start, when you water down and you compromise and just begin to blend in, it's just a matter of time till everything that's important gets lost. And, Mr. Armstrong had a way with words. Of course, that was his background. He was an advertiser. And he just had a way of labeling things. And back in 78, January 78, at the ministerial conference, Mr. Armstrong was there to open the conference. And the first day, and then he left on a trip to the Far East. And after he was gone, they passed out this big, thick notebook called the Systematic Theology Project, nicknamed as STP. And later on, Mr. Armstrong found out about it. He very quickly dubbed STP as standing for Sliding Toward Protestantism. That was the way he labeled it, and that's what it was. It wasn't Protestantism, but it was sliding toward Protestantism. That was what he recognized, and is in effect. See, when Ezra came back, and he saw that everything was on the verge of being lost. The people, the Jews, were beginning to just blend in. They were accepting pagan practices. They were intermarrying with the world around and just on the verge of losing their identity. So Ezra called people together and that they were to make proclamation, chapter 10, verse 7, to gather together in Jerusalem. Whoever wouldn't come had 3 days to get there. Whoever wouldn't come, his substance was to be forfeited, and he was to be separated from the congregation. So they gathered themselves together, and Ezra stood up, verse 10, and said, "You have transgressed. You've taken strange wives to increase the trespass of Israel. So we make confession to the Lord God of your fathers and do his pleasure. Separate yourselves from the people of the land and from the strange wives." And the people... the congregation said, "As you've said, so must we do." And they said, "Well, it's going to take a little time." And verse 10, verse 13, "The people are many, and it's a time of much rain, and we're not able to stand outside. Neither is this a work of one day or two. We're many that have transgressed in this thing. Let now our rulers of all the congregation stand, and let all them which have taken strange wives in our cities come at the appointed times." And
So what we find is they said, well, look, it's going to take a little longer and it's raining and we don't want to stand outside and listen to all this. Why don't you get the leaders together and you get it all worked out with them? Well, the result of the thing was that there appeared to be, there was an initial agreement. But as we skip about 12 years to the opening of the book of Nehemiah, we find out that not a whole lot actually happened. When we come on down here to Nehemiah chapter 1, we find that Nehemiah found out that, verse 3 of Nehemiah 1, that the remnant that are left of the captivity are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down. The gates are still burned up with fire. And Nehemiah was really upset that nothing had been accomplished. He thought that it had been. He really besought God and prayed to God and confessed the sins of the people and asked God for a chance to, he says here in verse 11, O Lord, I beseech you, let now your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant, to the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name. And prosper, I pray you, your servant this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man, for I was the king's cupbearer. So, a little while later, Artaxerxes is here, and the king asked Nehemiah, what's wrong? And Nehemiah told him what the problem was. And the king said, verse 4, well, what do you want to do? So Nehemiah says, so I prayed to the God of heaven. You know, he just breathed a quick, silent prayer, and then he came out with it. He said, well, what I'd really like to do is to go back and to see that Jerusalem is rebuilt. And the king quizzed him a little bit about how long was it going to take and how long did he want to be gone. And so he was appointed as the governor. Now, Nehemiah came back with these letters from the king. And notice verse 10. Of chapter 2. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant the Ammonite heard of it, it grieved them exceedingly that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. Oh boy, that just ruined their day when they found out somebody had actually come back to do something. And Nehemiah got to Jerusalem. He was there 3 days. And he got up in the night when nobody much was stirring around. And he went out, verse 13, by night, by the gate of the valley. And he went down and he viewed the walls of Jerusalem. And he sort of walked around and got a view of things. And then he called the leaders together. In verse 17, he said, you see the distress we're now in. Jerusalem lies waste. The gates are burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we be no more a reproach. And I told them of the hand of my God that was good upon me, as also the king's words that he had spoken unto me. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for this good work. And so, first thing Nehemiah did, it's interesting, what Nehemiah was facing a crisis. He came and first he surveyed the situation to see what was going on. Then he called the people, he called the leaders together, and he gave them a pep talk. He said, look, we've got a job to do. We need to do it. And I told them of the hand of my God that was good upon me. You know, he tried to encourage them and build up their faith and show how God was, all the things God had done to bless him and to bring him there. And so he ended up saying, let's rise and build. So they strengthened their hands for this good work. You know, he stirred them up, sort of motivated them. So he surveyed the situation, and then he sought to motivate the leaders. Now, when Sanballat and Tobiah saw this, verse 19, they heard it, they laughed us to scorn. So they ridiculed. You know, this is one of the tactics that the enemies will use. They ridicule. And I answered them, verse 20, and said, the God of heaven, he'll prosper us. We're his servants. We'll arise and build. You have no portion, nor right, nor memorial in Jerusalem. You don't have anything to do with this. I don't want you guys hanging around here. Well, the next thing you find in chapter 3 is Nehemiah organized things. You know, They had had years to get this project done, and they hadn't gotten much done. What you find is you go through chapter 3, starting here with Eliashib the high priest. He and his brethren, the priests, they built the sheep gate and sanctified it and set up the doors. And next to them, verse 2, built the men of Jericho. And next to them, and you go all the way around the wall. You could, if you had a map of Jerusalem with chapter 3, you could trace all the way around. Nehemiah organized. He had a group responsible for every single thing. So he was a very organized individual. He surveyed the situation, gave a motivational pep talk. Then he got things organized. He broke a giant project down into a lot of very small increments and assigned each group to their little spot. So he got things organized out. And it goes all the way around as to what they did. And you see, by the time you get to verse 32, between the going up of the corner under the sheep gate, repaired the goldsmiths and the merchants. The sheep gate's where he started, so he's worked his way all the way around the wall. And he got everybody involved. And everybody had a section that they were responsible for, a small section. Well, when Sanballat, chapter 4, heard that we built the wall, he was wroth. Oh, he was mad. Took great indignation, mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren, the army of Samaria. And he said, what are these feeble Jews going to do? And so they ridiculed, made fun. And Tobiah, verse 3, said, why a fox could knock down their little wall. And so there is, you know, all sorts of ridicule and sarcasm. And verse 6, so we built the wall. And all the wall was joined together under the half thereof. The people had a mind to work. And when Sanballat and his crew heard that the wall of Jerusalem was made up, that the breaches began to be stopped, they were furious. They conspired, all of them again, together to come up and fight against Jerusalem and to hinder it. We made our prayer unto our God and set a watch against them day and night. So, you know, they tried to infiltrate through compromise. They tried to take the heart and the spirit of the people away through ridicule and sarcasm and things of that sort. And when that wasn't successful, they decided, they plotted together and said, we'll just come up there and we'll make them stop. We'll bring an army up there. Well, Nehemiah's philosophy was sort of, pray and pass the ammunition. We made our prayers and set a watch. People came to him in verse 10 and said, well, look, you know, people are just getting worn out. The strength of the bearers of burden is decayed. There's so much rubbish. They're not able to build the wall. All this junk is piled up. And the adversaries are using all this and are going to come up in the midst. So Nehemiah further organized things. And he inspired and encouraged the people. And verse 15, came to pass when our enemies heard that it was known among us that God had brought their counsel to naught, we returned all of us to the wall, everyone to his work. And half my servants, verse 16, wrought in the work, and the other half of them held both the spears and the shields and the bows. And so they built on the walls. And verse 18, the builders, everyone had his sword girded by his side, and so they built it. He that sounded the trumpet was with me. And I told the nobles that the work is great and large, were separated upon the wall. And in what place thereof you hear the sound of the trumpet, come there. Our God will fight for us. So we labored in the work, verse 21. Half of them held the spears from the rising of the morning till the stars appeared. And verse 23, neither I nor my brethren nor my servants nor the men of the guard that followed me, none of us put off our clothes except everyone put them off for washing. You know, it says, I didn't even take off my clothes at night. You know, we just, we were there, we were on guard around the clock. We just changed our clothes just to wash them. We never let down his guard. So here Nehemiah was, we find he was organized. He was not a fellow that you could intimidate. And he was prepared to put forth tremendous effort and energy on a project. And as you come on down through the story, chapter 6, verse 15 tells us the wall was finished in the 25th day of the month Elul in 52 days. It had years to build this thing. And nobody could get anything done. It's amazing what can be done when somebody is organized and motivated. And Nehemiah was, he was organized and he was motivated. And in 52 days, he finished what they dragged on for 52 years. But you see, nobody, there was just nothing that was being done in an organized way. Some people have taken exception to the idea that there should be a government or structure in the church. Well, you know, 1 Corinthians 14:33, God's not the author of confusion. You can't have a group of people and have no structure and expect not to have confusion. That's what they had, and nothing had gotten accomplished. Nehemiah was able to accomplish more in 2 months' time than had been accomplished in all these years, because he was motivated and he was organized. And he also had God's blessing. And that, of course, was the greatest key, but he was doing his part. And being motivated and being organized was a crucial thing. Now, chapter 5 brings up a problem that we find that people had not been... had time to do the work, but they'd had time to take advantage of one another. In chapter 5, it talks about being a great cry of the people and their wives against their brethren, the Jews. And here were people, verse 3, who had mortgaged their land, their vineyards, that they might buy grain because of the drought. They borrowed money to pay their taxes. And here were some of their wealthier brethren who had done this and now were foreclosing and taking advantage. In verse 7, Nehemiah consulted. He said, "I consulted with myself, and I rebuked the nobles and the rulers and said unto them, 'You exact usury, every one of his brother,' and I set a great assembly against them." So he told them, verse 9, "It's not good that you do what you do. You need to walk in the fear of God because of the reproach of the heathen, our enemies." So he made them restore what they had taken, and he put the pressure on them, and they agreed to restore it. He addressed the issue. Now, chapter 6. "When Sanballat and the others heard that I built the wall and that there was no breach left, Sanballat came," verse 2, "and said, 'Let's meet together over here in the village, in one of the villages of the plain. You know, we need to talk with you. Let's have a little conference. Let's meet over here.'" But notice the end of verse 2. "But they sought to do me mischief." They thought to do me mischief. Nehemiah knew what they were up to. "And he would not be diverted." See, this is, I think, one of the interesting things. Nehemiah was a very single-minded individual. And so they invited him over here to this meeting. Verse 3, "I sent messengers unto them saying, 'I'm doing a great work, so I can't come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it to come down to you?'" You know what? I've got a job to do, and I don't have time to waste my time coming over there where you are. "So they sent unto me 4 times after this sort, and I answered them after the same matter." They kept saying, "Oh, well, come on over. Look, we've got this real important thing. We need to talk to you. And, man, I think we could get all this stuff worked out. You know, come over here and talk with us." Well, Nehemiah wouldn't come. He didn't have anything to talk with them about. He knew what he was going to do. He didn't want anything to do with them. There was nothing to talk about. So then Sanballat, see, first he tries to entice him. So that doesn't work. So then the 5th time, there was an open letter in his hand, verse 6, wherein it was written, "It is reported among the heathen," and this fellow says it, "that you and the Jews think to rebel, for which cause you're building this wall, that you may be their king." So now he accused him. He said, "Now, you know, we know why you're doing all this. You're going to rebel and set yourself up as king. And you've appointed prophets to preach of you at Jerusalem." So they're accusing him. And this is going to be reported to the king. You better come over here and meet with us and let's take counsel together, verse 7. See, they tried to entice him. Now they tried to intimidate him. They said, boy, we've heard these bad reports, and man, the king is not going to like it when he hears. And if you won't come meet with us, we're going to send this thing. We're going to send this bad report to the king. So I sent unto them, verse 8, saying, there are no such things done as you say. You've made it up out of your own heart. For they all made us afraid, saying, your hand shall be weakened from the work, that it shall not be done. Now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. You know, Nehemiah knew what they were trying to do. He just prayed to God and kept on going. And afterward, I came to the house of Shemaiah, and he said, here in verse 10, let's meet together in the house of God within the temple. Let's shut the doors of the temple. They'll come to slay you. Yes, in the night they'll come to slay you. And I said, verse 11, should such a man as I flee? Who is there that, being as I am, should go into the temple to save his life? I won't go in. I'm not going to go in there. That's the priests are the only ones supposed to go in there. I'm not going to go in there. Am I scared? Am I going to hide from them? Verse 12, I perceived that God had not sent him. He had pronounced this prophecy against me for Tobiah, and Sanballat had hired him. See, he was hired, that I should be afraid and do so and sin, that they might have matter for an evil report. He knew what they were up to. You know, they try one way after another. So the wall was finished. It came to verse 16, when all our enemies heard thereof and the heathen saw these things, they were much cast down in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was wrought of God. So they, you know, they just didn't like this, these other nations. Well, there were many in Jerusalem. Verse 17. In those days, the nobles of Judah sent many letters unto Tobiah, and letters of Tobiah came unto them. For there were many in Judah sworn unto him, because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah, and they reported, verse 19, his good deeds before me, and uttered my words to him. Tobiah sent letters to put me in fear. You know, here were people who were supposed to be a part of things there in Jerusalem that were really had their sympathies with Tobiah. When the wall was built, I set up the doors, and gathered the nation, the nobles, and the people, the rulers, here in verse 5. And it mentions the ones come together all through here in chapter 7. And this whole great congregation that were come together mentions them all. In verse 8, or chapter 8, verse 1, the people gathered themselves together as one man in the street that was before the water gate. And Ezra the scribe brought the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had commanded. And he brought the law, and everybody stood up. This was on the first day of the seventh month. This is chapter 8, verse 2. Feast of Trumpets. And he read therein before the street. And he read the law. Verse 8, he read in the book of the law of God distinctly and gave the sense, caused them to understand the reading. So he didn't just drone on. He read it and he expounded it. He explained to them what it meant so that they would understand it. And so they instructed the people in terms of keeping the feast, and they observed the Feast of Tabernacles, as it's described on here in chapter 8. Then, on the eighth day, verse 18, the last part, they kept the feast 7 days, and on the eighth day was a solemn assembly. Then, now we've come a couple of days later, chapter 9, Nehemiah assembles all the people together with fasting, and told them to separate themselves from the strangers, verse 2. And they stood and confessed their sins. And they stood up in their place and read in the book of the law. And they read in the book of the law of the Lord their God 1/4 part of the day, and another 1/4 part they confessed and worshiped the Lord God. So they spent a large part of the day reading, studying, and praying. And it goes through this in confession of God's goodness and of the national sins that are laid out here in chapter 9. And so they made a sure covenant, chapter 9, verse 38. And then those that signed the covenant starts out here in chapter 10. Nehemiah signed it, and then all these others. And verse 28, all the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the porters, the singers, the Nephonim, and all they that had separated themselves from the people of the land under the law of God, their wives, their sons, their daughters, everyone having knowledge and having understanding, they clave to their brethren, their nobles, and entered into a curse and into an oath to walk in God's law that was given by Moses, to observe and do all the commandments. And this included refusal to intermarry and not to be involved in trading and commerce on the Sabbath and all of the various things that were involved here. They were going to goes into tithing as you come on down through the rest of chapter 10. Well, the goes on here of the bringing in, increasing the population of Jerusalem in chapter 11, and continues on with some of these priests and goes into the details of some of the organization here in chapter 12. Now, as we come on down, that here in chapter 13 starts out about the instructions concerning the Moabites and the Ammonites, and now notice that verse 4 of chapter 13. Before this, Eliashib the priest. Now remember, we read about him in chapter way back at the beginning of Nehemiah. He was the high priest. He was the one who was so involved in the work. He was the one that he and his brethren, the priests, started out on the first section of the wall, rebuilding it, the sheep gate. Eliashib the priest, having the oversight of the chamber of the house of our God, was allied unto Tobiah. Now you come to the real crux of it. This man who was the high priest, who seemingly had been so involved in the work, he was actually secretly allied to Tobiah. And he had prepared for him a great chamber, where before time they used to lay the meal offerings and the frankincense and the vessels and the tithes of grain and wine. But, verse 6, in all this time was I not at Jerusalem. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, I came to the king, and after certain days I obtained leave and came back. So he was gone for a little period of time. When he gets back, what does he find? But in his absence, Eliashib the high priest has actually let Tobiah move into the temple. One of the chambers where they used to use for storage of tithes and offerings and some of the chambers of the priests, Eliashib had an apartment right here in the temple. And when he got there, verse 7, when I came to Jerusalem and understood the evil that Eliashib did for Tobiah in preparing a chamber in the courts of the house of God, it grieved me sore. Therefore I cast forth all the household stuff of Tobiah out of the chamber. And I commanded, and they cleansed the chamber. You know, you can just sort of see all of a sudden flying out the window, here went the couch, and here went the chair, and here went the dishes, here went the whole thing. You know, I came in there, and Nehemiah said, I couldn't believe it. They let this guy move in. And I cleansed the chamber. I cleaned it out. I got rid of all of his stuff. I cast forth all the household stuff out of the chamber. That's why I have the idea that he didn't just, have some people sort of carefully carry it down the stairs. I think he threw it out the window. I cast out all of his household stuff. When Nehemiah was upset, he was upset. And I cleansed the chamber, had him scrub it down, and brought the things back in. Verse 10, I perceived the portions of the Levites had not been given to them. The Levites and the singers that did the work, they were fled, everyone to his field. You see, the leadership quit doing what they were. They weren't doing what was right. Well, that discouraged the faith and the obedience of the people, so the people weren't tithing. And so the Levites, instead of being there and carrying out the functions in the temple, they'd all gone out to a farm and started raising crops because, it was just sort of a vicious cycle. So Nehemiah comes in, temple's pretty well deserted, things aren't being carried out because, the Levites, no, they're not here anymore. They're out over there, they're farming that field because... verse 11, I contended with the rulers. I said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together and I set them in their place. And then brought all Judah the tithe of the corn and the new wine and the oil into the treasuries. Nehemiah began to get a little bit forceful. I made treasurers over the treasures, the treasuries. And he mentions the ones that he appointed. For they were counted faithful, in the verse 13. And their office was to distribute unto their brethren. So in verse 15, in those days I saw in Judah some treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in sheaves. Just treating it like a normal work day. And I testified against them in the day wherein they sold victuals. In other words, they were just treating it as a normal work day. They were loading up crops and bringing them into town and just going about their business. And men of Tyre, verse 16, who brought fish and all manner of ware, and they sold them on the Sabbath to the children of Judah. Just business as usual, just a normal work day. And I contended with the nobles of Judah, verse 17, and I said, what evil thing is this you do? Profane the Sabbath. Didn't your fathers do this? Didn't God bring all this evil upon us and upon this city? Yet you bring more wrath upon Israel by profaning the Sabbath? It came to pass when the gates of Jerusalem began to be dark before the Sabbath, I commanded that the gates should be shut. And I charged that they should not be opened to lay any burden in on the Sabbath. They were just bringing in donkeys laden down with crops, and it's just business as usual. Well, the merchants and the sellers of all kind of ware lodged outside of Jerusalem once or twice. They didn't take the hint. In verse 21, I testified against them, and I said, what are you doing out here? If you do so again, I'm going to lay hands on you. From that time forth, they came no more on the Sabbath. So Nehemiah explained it to them, and they didn't think he was going to ordain them either when he laid hands on them. I commanded the Levites that they should cleanse themselves, that they should come and keep the gates and sanctify the Sabbath day. So, verse 23, in those days I saw Jews that married wives of Ashdod and Ammon and Moab, and their children spoke half in the speech of Ashdod and couldn't speak Hebrew but according to the language of each people. And I contended with them, verse 25, and cursed them and smote certain of them and plucked off their hair. And when I got through with them, I made them swear by God, saying, you're not going to give your daughters to their sons nor take their daughters to your sons for yourselves. Didn't Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? And so evidently they began to get the point, as Nehemiah explained it to them. So it's just all a matter of how you explained it. So verse 28. One of the sons of Joiada, the son of Eliashib the high priest, was son-in-law to Sanballat the Horonite, wherefore I chased him from me. Now, why the problem had never been solved up until now? Because Eliashib the high priest was an ally. And we now find his grandson, who was in line for the high priesthood, was actually the son-in-law now, had married the daughter of Sanballat. Now, this is the origin of the Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim. Josephus tells the rest of the story. This priest's name was blotted out of the genealogy, and he's just the grandson. His name is mentioned here in Nehemiah. Josephus gives his name, Jonathan. And when Nehemiah chased him out, where do you think he went? Well, he went to Samaria. He went up there to daddy-in-law, Sanballat. And Sanballat said, well, that's okay, son. If they won't let you be a priest down here, we'll just build you a temple up here, and you can be a priest up here. So they built a temple on Mount Gerizim. And the line of the priesthood, you see, changed at this point. And so the contention, the Samaritans claimed, we've got the legitimate succession of the priesthood, you see. We have
you know, we have the legitimate succession here, and it came on down through this Jonathan, who was the grandson of Eliashib. And the Samaritans built their temple on Mount Gerizim, and they had their things there, and the Jews were in Jerusalem. And the Samaritans changed the text of the law. They made additions and substitutions wherever it suit their fancy, to where they made it appear that Mount Gerizim was the place. See, that was where Moses had the blessings pronounced when Israel crossed the Jordan, Deuteronomy. So they just said, well, you see, this is the place. And they sort of changed things around. So when the woman at the well met Christ, and she said, our fathers say this mountain, but you Jews say Jerusalem. This is the origin of the issue. The Samaritans actually still worshipped in Mount Gerizim, but they didn't have a temple, because that was one of the things the Maccabees did when they got through restoring the true temple in Jerusalem. They had a little energy left over, so they went up to Mount Gerizim and tore the Samaritans' temple down. But the Samaritans used that, it closes, you see, with a curse on this priestly family. Verse 29, remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and of the Levites. Thus cleansed I them from all strangers, and appointed the wards of the priests and the Levites, everyone in his business. And for the wood offering at the times appointed, and for the first fruits, remember me, O God, for my good. You know, the things that you find right here that you find Sabbath breaking and idolatry. You find this mixing with the world around. You know, the two things that involved losing their identity. The Sabbath, it's a sign between me and my people forever. It identifies. Well, as the people were abandoning the Sabbath and transgressing the Sabbath, treating it as a work day. You know, there are two extremes. The tendency described here, and the tendency, I think, the most common tendency, and the tendency, I think, of our time, is the extreme of liberalizing, watering down, and just treating the Sabbath very casually. This was the problem. When you come to the New Testament period, you find the Pharisees who were sort of self-appointed, and they had focused on the Sabbath, and they looked at these things. So their solution to it was to build a fence around the law, as they called it. And they enacted all sorts of human traditions that went way beyond what God's commandments were, to where Christ rebuked them for having made the Sabbath a burden to the people. God didn't make the Sabbath a burden, but the Pharisees made the Sabbath a burden to the people. And you start, they got so bent out of shape about every sort of thing, because you see the point they all missed, the point that both extremes miss, is the spirit of the law. What is it God's after? God wants you to hallow, and God wants you to hallow the Sabbath day because it's a day to worship Him. The purpose of the Sabbath is not an end in and of itself. The Sabbath is a means to an end. It is a day for God's people to be able to assemble, to fellowship with God first and foremost, and secondarily with one another. You know, Malachi says those that feared the Eternal spoke often one to another. So it was, you know, the Sabbath has a purpose. Either extreme defeats the purpose. When you disregard the Sabbath, treat it just as a casual day, and you work and you spend the day at the mall, and you're out to doing this, that, and the other, pursuing your own interests and pleasure, you go to the ball game, go to the movies, just treat the Sabbath like any old day. Well, you're certainly not. That's wrong. You're not getting the benefit God intended. On the other hand,
when you come up with a lot of humanly devised do's and don'ts and rules and make the Sabbath a burden, the Pharisees got into all sorts of complicated things, you know, because they would sit around and discuss, well, you know, you're not supposed to travel on the Sabbath. How far can you go without traveling? And they got into all sorts of complicated things. They would make rules that were burdensome, and they would come up with little technicalities as to how you could get around this one or that one. And it missed the whole point. And Christ had much contention. The Pharisees thought Christ wasn't careful enough in keeping the Sabbath. Well, Christ kept the Sabbath perfectly. So, you know, we see here Nehemiah had to deal with one set of problems, and Christ had to deal with another set of problems. There are generally two ditches on the road. And you know, so many times, if you get people out of one ditch, they aim straight across for the other ditch. You know, well, hey, there is a road in between. Why not just stay out of the ditches and stick to the road? But that seems hard for human nature to do. And so we find the extremes. But one of the things that is clear here in Ezra and Nehemiah, that what was at stake was the very identity and survival of the Jewish people. Christ, the Messiah, was going to come in unto his own. To come to an identifiable people who had maintained and preserved the law of God. Satan was had an all-out attack to destroy the preservation of the truth. And this was his attempt. You see, always, either through assimilation or through persecution, through either enticing people to sort of lose their identity and just blend in, or to persecute and to try to destroy and to wipe out. You've got the two, you know, sort of the twin attack. And you find it through the Old Testament, and you find it in the history of the New Testament church. You find the story all the way down. And so it's a fascinating story that is told in Ezra and Nehemiah. And sometimes people look and they say, well, boy, you know, Nehemiah, Ezra came back and he told them what to do, and Nehemiah, and how in the world could... People can't get off the track that quickly. Oh, yes, they can. You know, remember the 70s? How long it took things to swing off? Mr. Armstrong said, well, I'm going to put the church back on the track. He had 7 years of doing that. Boy, things were on the track. How long was he dead before, the train was off the track and nowhere to be found? They couldn't even find the track. I mean, they're so far gone, they don't even know where the track is. And it didn't take them very long. You know, what we see from our own experience is not dissimilar to what you read in Ezra and Nehemiah. It sort of makes these things understandable. When you realize human nature hadn't changed a whole lot, and the tendency of people is to sort of go with the flow. And God's looking not for people who just go with the flow, but he's looking for people who stand for something, who are committed to something, and are prepared, whether it's popular or unpopular. But a lot of levels on which you can study the book of Nehemiah, and interesting even just from a standpoint of a man that God used to lead his nation at a crucial time. Next Bible study, we're going to cover the time between the Testaments to sort of set the stage for an introduction to the New Testament. We will come back to... ultimately, we're going to cover all of the books of the Old Testament. We've been going through in the order of a historical survey of the Old Testament. So now we've come up to the conclusion of the story as told in the Old Testament. We'll look next time at the time between the Testaments, and then we'll go into a survey of the Gospels and Acts, and follow basically the story flow of the Bible through. Then we'll come back for the major prophets and for the general epistles and for Paul's epistles, and we will come minor prophets. We'll come back and pick each of these segments up. So there aren't study questions for next time because it's not there's not a specific book we're going through, but sort of to cover that time period. So I look forward to seeing you Sabbath.